Hello. Thank you, Tom, and it's a pleasure to be here. I know this is a quant finance seminar. I'm actually from the business school, economics and finance department, and my students always complain about, you know, my stuff is too mathematical, and my doctoral director had a heart-to-heart with me recently saying that I would like you to teach our option pricing class, but can you just simplify it? At least spend half of the semester teach the John Howe's book and then get into your stuff. So here I'm trying to come up with something simpler, you know, instead of using Fourier transforms, these FFT stuff, characteristic functions, try to ask them to solve, fit the whole implied surface using, say, sixth grade math, just solve a quadratic equation. We'll see where we can go with that. So first, I want to kind of clarify on the literatures in terms of what is inputs, what is outputs, and how you calibrate the model. And we actually, Peter and I spent quite some time on these terminologies, and we don't agree with each other. He's trying to build a generic term. But to me, this is how I classify the models. So for the current standard option pricing literature in the academic normally, your starting point, this is what I call the starting point, is the initial stock price and all kinds of financing conditions like the dividends, interest rates, although we don't really know the future dividends, right? And that's a big thing in the industry. You actually, people spend money to buy commercial forecasts on the dividends. But most of the option pricing models we're dealing with, we kind of take the dividend as given, right? And take the rate as given, although we don't really know which rate to use. And there's borrow cost, right, these short selling kind of constraints. But normally, we assume we know that already. That's our starting point, right? If you're doing discounted cash flow model to evaluate equity, that's not your starting point, obviously. Your starting point will be some earnings, those kind of stuff. But here, our starting point is the stock price and some financing conditions, right? So that we're not modeling. We're taking it as given. We just assume that we can buy and sell that stock at that price and the financing conditions there that we can do, okay? And what's the assumption? The assumptions are essentially the model, right? We assume something about how the stock price moves and if it has stochastic vol, how the vol moves, right? It's constant. And from these specifications and the starting points, you can derive the level and the shape of the implied volatility surface. So given that today's stock price is 100. Given our assumption that it's going to move to the future in a certain way, we know today's vol surface should have a certain shape. Okay, if the volatility, if the stock price moves and the volatility move tends to have negative correlations, we know that the vol surface tends to be skewed to the negatively. Right, those kind of constraints. Okay, that's what we derive. And for calibration, you need to really put the model into application. How do we calibrate it? Basically, we observe a finite number of options or finite number of implied volatility quotes, and we try to fit the model parameters to these quotes. And given this fits, then we can do interpolate. We can do the whole vol surface, right? You have 5, 10 quotes, then you can get the whole vol surface, right? So you can be, that can be used as an interpolation and extrapolation tool in a sense. You can use the options you have, say, at the short term to extrapolate to the long term or interpolate in the middle, right? And also, if you have a good model, to the extent that you believe in your model, and to the extent that you do not fit the observed option price perfectly, that can also be a good thing, right? That pricing error can potentially be alpha, can be trading opportunities if those errors are transient. That is, you have an error today, tomorrow the error is going to be gone. That's good, right? Obviously, the model also gives you risk exposures. That's a good thing. It tells you what are the risk sources, how do you hedge these risks. So if your model generates pricing error, if you use your model to hedge away all the risks and bet on those errors, and if your model is good, the error should go away, you can make money on that. So you can use the model in terms of interpolation, extrapolation for market makers and alpha generation for investors, depending on how well your model fits and how, which kind of client you're dealing with, right? That's the traditional kind of standard option pricing model approach. And since the traders like to use implied volatility quotes a lot, so some of the literature, mostly in the more in the applied, probably also in the math side, a few people have been trying to develop something called market models of implied volatilities. They said, since we always want to quote on implied vols from Black-Scholes model, why don't we directly model the dynamics on implied volatility? Right? So that's a natural thought. I think there's your analogy of that to the HGM path model. Right? HGM says that since we're trading forwards, let me directly model forwards rates. And then there's also this market model on LIBOR stuff. Right? I think the forward model analogy is kind of clearer. I take the whole forward curve as given. I specify the margin yield component, the movements of the forward rates, the whole curve. Then I, based on dynamic the arbitrage, I derive how the drift should be, right? So that's what they're trying to do on implied vol. Says that I take the whole vol surface as given, but that's our starting point. So immediately what that says is that I cannot use this model to generate alpha on the vol surface anymore. I can use it to price options on vols, right? But not tell me whether the vol is good or bad. Whatever the vol I get, right? Because I'm taking it as my starting point, not the stock price. Still, you can use the if the model is calibrated, you can use the model to generate risk exposures and price exotic options, right? So the assumption is only on the margin yield component of the implied vol, and the implication through this dynamic arbitrage is to get the drift, right? So you get the drift of the process. I put the question mark on the calibration because normally we're dealing with vanilla options. If I take the vanilla vol surface as given, the calibration becomes a little bit weird. How do I calibrate this model? So probably I really need options on implied vol to do the calibration. Right? And normally this literature didn't go anywhere actually. It's kind of stopped. And recently I saw a presentation from Jim Gatherill. It has a sentence that says that implied vol models is a dead end because most of these derivations, what they find is that the drift is just a mess. You don't really get anything out of it. And also, since the relation is so complex, people don't really know what the current you're taking the vol surface is given, right? You don't really know what the vol surface, its implication on your dynamics. You said, okay, the vol surface looks like that, something like that. And that has actually had implications on the dynamics. And if you specify something else, it may not be consistent, right? For example, if the vol smile going that way, and you assume that the margin yield component of the implied vol is positively correlated with the stock price, it may not be really consistent, right? So you have those kind of concerns. The key is it's just not tractable. So it doesn't satisfy my simple kind of criteria, right? It's complex, it's a mess. So what we do is like a slight switch of input-output. So our starting point is still just the stock price, and our output actually is still the vol surface. So I'm still working on the vanilla vol surface. I'm not trying to price exotic options, okay? You could, but that's not my purpose. The only difference is in the middle. So we specify the stock price dynamics, but instead of specifying, say, the instantaneous return balance rate, like in Hasdan or the stochastic vol models, we specify the implied volatility dynamics. Both the drift and the diffusion. Then people said, you cannot do that because those market guys says that if I specify the market yield component, I can derive the drift, right? So how can you specify both? Well, their assumption is that given the initial vol surface, right, and then you say the surface plus the market yield component, that determines the drift, right? So that's what they're trying to say. The problem is that if you have a bad surface, your implied drift is wild, basically, right? So what we're doing is we specify both the margin yield and drift component. Based on our specification of the dynamics, we imply a surface, right? So it's just the three things. You just specify two, generate the other. The surface we generate would be smoother, and it does not necessarily fit whatever you observe, right? And that could be a good thing or a bad thing. If my specification is wild, I cannot fit anything. That's a bad model. If my specification is good, I fit well, or my error is transient, I can use it as alpha, that's good, right? So in that sense, it's similar, to me, it's very similar to the standard option pricing literature. Peter think of it as more like it on the implied value literature, but to me, it's on the other side a little bit more, okay? So the calibration is much like the standard literature, right? So I use a finite number of implied vol quotes, whatever is available. I calibrate these coefficients that determines the vol dynamic, implied vol dynamics. Based on the calibration, we generate the whole implied vol surface. So it's not much different in that sense. But the model we come up with is extremely simple, as I said earlier. It's just sort of a quadratic equation, which you can solve this negative b plus square root of b squared minus 4ac kind of stuff. So it's very fast also, right? Hefter model is one of the, I think, the mostly cited, almost most cited paper, right, in this literature, because if you specify the guess-to-vol, the square root process, or this kind of two-factor extension, is pretty much it. You cannot do much outside of it, even if it doesn't work, okay? People say log-normal model works better, three-half works better, but none of these models give you tractability. And the Hefter model is the most tractable model, in a sense. But even with that tractability, you need first derive the characteristic function of the stuck return, then you apply Fourier transform or some numerical integration to invert that Fourier transform, right? So it's a numerical procedure. It's fast, but still, for my calibration, I have about 570 weeks of weekly subdata, so 30,000 option points. My algorithm is quite fast. On my laptop, I can go through the whole surface using about 1 minute, a little bit more than 1 minute for Hefter model. But for the models that I'm going to propose today, it's less than a second. I'm calibrating 10 years of vol surface, right, in less than a second. So it's very fast, and it's so fast that normally people say, this stochastic vol model sounds good, but nobody can use it, especially for the market makers, because it's too complex. I cannot implement it then. But for the model we propose, you should be able to implement them, right? If you can do a quadratic fitting, you can do a fitting like that. The question is why we are so entrenched with the Black-Scholes implied volatilities. We all know that, I mean, as soon as you draw implied vol smile and the implied vol numbers are different at different strengths, you know the Black-Scholes model's assumptions are violated, right? If you know the assumptions are violated, why are you still using the implied vol? At least I think there are like three reasons. One is informational. It's just easier to see through what's going on through implied volatility than through option price. I guess in science you call it more like a representation, right? You have data, you have something. The question is how do you show, represent the data to reveal its underlying feature, right? So it's easier to reveal the feature using implied vols than using option prices. First, implied vol is a kind of scaled quantity, it's unitless. Option price is in dollars. So if I scale the stock price by 100, option price will go up by 100. So, but that doesn't really affect the underlying assumptions, right? So we don't want that. That, instead of using implied vol, you can quote option price in percentage of the underlying stock. That solves the problem, right? But as it, implied vol is one way to scale it. The other thing is that implied vol does not depend on intrinsic value, right? And the intrinsic value doesn't depend on a model, right? The only thing that depends on your dynamic assumption is the time value. But the option shape, when you draw a call option or a put option in terms of a strike, something like that, right? That kind of shape, no matter which model you assume, it always has that shape, right? Actually, there, a while ago, there's a very senior option pricing professor, actually, editor somewhere, wrote a paper saying that what's going on with all your models? Your model, you know, the model is very complicated, but I don't need a model because all I need is to fit that curve, right? I can use a very simple function to fit that curve. No matter which model I use, I can fit 90% of it. But that's the wrong thing because the curve is dominated by the intrinsic value shape, right? So that's not the part of your modeling, right? Intrinsic value is always going to be there. The part of your modeling is the time value part, I guess, when it's really the automatic component, right? And the implied vol just captures the time value component. It has nothing to do with the intrinsic value, right? So it gives, reveals the information more. Intrinsic value has no information about the dynamics. And the other thing is that the Black-Scholes model assumes the underlying return is normal. So it gives you a benchmark. everybody likes to use normal to start with, so normal is the benchmark, right? As soon as if you see implied bounds flat across strikes and maturities, you know Black-Scholes model assumption is correct, the return is normal. But as soon as you see the implied bound at low strike is higher than the high strike, you say the return is negatively skewed, right? You see the implied bound going up, you have the upward structure. Implied bound is varying over time, the stochastic evolve. So these information are reviewed directly from the implied bound kind of plot. But if you plot the option price, it's not reviewed as clearly. Okay? The other thing actually is more subtle, is no arbitrage constraints. Right? Merchant earlier classified this model free bonds and based on no arbitrage arguments. First it says that if I assume no arbitrage between one option or two options and the underlying, right? Then I can derive all these ones. Say call price has to be, call put price has to be greater than intrinsic value, call price should be less than the stock price, after discounting put price should be greater than the strike price, all these things you learn in a kind of MBA class, right? These non-arbitrage funds, and also put call parity should hold, okay? And in 1996, Hutch shows that as long as you can solve for a finite positive implied vol number, for the option price value, the type 1 type bonds are automatically satisfied. So that's very useful from a market maker's perspective, because for each stock you're quoting hundreds of options, right? You at least, regardless of what model you use, you at least going to guarantee that there's no model free arbitrage, right? You don't need to check it all the time. But as soon as you quote on an implied vol, that's automatically guaranteed. It doesn't guarantee all arbitrage, but it guarantees a big part of it, okay? And the last one actually is more like technological, also related to market makers, right? In the options market, the quote to trade ratio is about 100, 200. That is, you put out, you update your quote 200 times and you haven't received the order yet, right? But in the stock market, you put a quote, you get a trade. So the incentive is there to update your quote. But in the options market, the incentive is not there. You're not getting lots of transactions. You're not making money as fast. So you want some automation. And by quoting implied vol, you can be a bit more lazy. You said, I'm going to control the implied vol surface. If this order flow comes in, I'm going to adjust my implied vol accordingly. If there's no order flow, I can leave my implied vol there, right? I leave my original implied vol shape there. I'm just using a machine, plug in a machine, let the machine to do the Black-Scholes calculation, and link that machine to the stock market. Whenever the stock price moves, you just automatically update your option price. Right? That still guarantees no arbitrage. You may be late if the other guy updates well faster than you. You may be late. But still, it's not as bad as every time stock price moves, you are trying to move by yourself and there's no order comes in. Right? You work a lot without getting much in return. Right? So it's just technologically a more stable way to quote. Okay? But these kind of type 1 no arbitrage is not enough. Right? We want to kind of get a little bit more. And we want to get more constraints on the vol surface and to get some directional views on that. And in this paper, basically, we want to make further assumptions. These are without assumptions, right? Here, we want to make more assumptions on the implied vol dynamics so that we can gain some more constraints on the relative value of implied vols. You know, the implied vol at low strike versus high strike and, you know, low maturity versus high maturity and things like that. So what do we assume? Zero rates, just for clarity, there's no dividend. And we use diffusion stock price dynamics. Okay. ST would be the instantaneous return volatility. Its dynamics is not specified. Instead, we assume that the implied vol for each option contract, strike and expiry, follows this also diffusive process. Mu T and omega T has not been specified yet. These are just kind of notations. In principle, these things can depend on the implied vol itself for now. The key assumption here is it's a diffusion, it's one factor, a single factor. The whole vol surface is driven by one Brownian motion. That's the key assumption, a big assumption in that sense. But the vol surface may move in different ways, but that's a big assumption. And we also allow the vol surface to be correlated with the stock price. Right. So that's the key assumption. This is, would be the one factor diffusion on the vol surface. That's the key assumption. Okay, and to derive something on the vol surface, we assume no dynamic arbitrage between any options and a basis option. So it's kind of two options, no arbitrage. But if you have three or have four, and can you form a static arbitrage? Possibly yes, depends on my specification. If my specification is not good enough, possibly yes. I didn't really control for that. Okay, that's more for future research. But I guarantee dynamic no arbitrage. And the implication of dynamic no arbitrage is that this option by itself, you know, the option value has to follow to be a martingale and a risk neutral measure, right? And intuitively speaking, since you have two Brownian motions, you can do, you know, hedging, Greek hedging on these two lines, delta and vega hedging, and get rid of the risk. And based on this kind of arguments, we derive a fundamental PDE in terms of the B, which is the Black-Scholes formula, not in terms of the option value, right? In terms of the Black-Scholes formula. So this PDE actually is a joint relation between the Black-Scholes functional form, right? Just the functional form that you use, and the implied valve, right? Normally you said, okay, I'm going to have parameters, and then I have my option pricing function, whatever that comes out. Here, this is a joint thing of the Black-Scholes pricing formula and the implied valve, which links the theta of the option to the vega, gamma, vana, and voga. And all these Greeks are defined on the Black-Scholes model with the implied valve of that contract, right? Because these are matching the market prices. So it's more like using the running implied to calculate Black-Scholes Greeks, okay? So we call it a vega, gamma, vana, voga model because it's all the Greeks. And so now, since these functional forms are all in terms of the Black-Scholes formula, right? So you can derive all the derivatives as a function of the gamma, and since the dollar gamma has to be strictly positive, right, for positive maturity, then you can scale them out. Then the PDE reduced to a algebraic equation. So PDE, my students are scared of, and now it's just a simple algebraic equation on implied vowels. So essentially, this equation links the implied vowel shape to its dynamics, the mu, the omega, the rho, and things like that, right? So it's not exactly a fully specified equation here because I didn't specify the mu or the omega, but it reduces to this kind of equation. And a few guys from Deutsche Bank, they actually have a very similar model. They set that to zero. They come up with this thing where they only have kind of a few terms, and they do a fitting in a, how do I say it, maturity by maturity. Essentially, they get a quadratic format at each maturity. And to them, to the trade, actually, it's very intuitive because they're just linking the theta to vana and voga, right? So they don't have vega exposure in that case. They only have gamma, vana, and voga. So they said, okay, I need to balance this. I use three instruments to balance that. All the others are implied by this kind of balance. So, but a ideal way to represent the vowel surface is more informative way to represent the vowel surface, not in terms of strike and expiration date, but in terms of something called a standardized moneyness, which is like the D2, negative D2, and time to maturity. Because D2, under the Black-Scholes model at least, if you say it's under the Black-Scholes model, it really measures the number of standard deviations. It's the standardized variable, right? It measures the number of standard deviations the strike is away from the spot. So it's a kind of standardized measure, okay? So here, these are just a translation of that. It still looks complex, but if we go further, let's assume that the implied variance follows this new reverting dynamics, right? Just simple AR1 essentially dynamics with some volatility. Here I have square root of variance, which is a vowel. So I call it a square root process. Very much like a Heston, I guess. Heston is on V, on instantaneous variance, not on implied vowel, but this specification looks like Heston, except I add something here because these are implied vowels. Think of it as an aggregation, right? So I need to add something there to guarantee stationarity. Okay. But if I plug this in, then this whole equation still looks ugly, but it becomes really a quadratic equation, right? You have a V square. This is just a redefinition of the vowel surface. I just want to use a different functional form. V square, a V, and like A V square plus B V plus a constant, right? So the whole wall surface, the whole wall surface now can be solved as a solution to the quadratic equation. The quadratic equation has two solutions. One is negative, the other is positive. Obviously, you take the positive one for the wall surface, and it's done like that. Okay. But these specifications, the drawback of specifying implied wall is that you don't really know how it should go. Specifying on its continuous variance is kind of clear, right? Whether my specification makes sense or not, it's harder to see. So you can do some double check, right? First, let's say in the limit, right? If in the limit, when tau goes to zero, the wall surface implied wall has to converge to the instantaneous volatility. Right? That's by the arbitrage without any model assumed. This thing, you can plug them in, it satisfies that. And in the long run, when tau goes to infinity, it equals to the risk neutral mean of the implied wall. This is based on my assumption, based on that part. If I set eta to zero, it becomes kind of non-stationary, the wall can keep going, right? By adding a strictly positive eta here, I kind of discount it so that long-term implied wall are not as volatile as short-term implied wall, and then you have a convergence, okay? And for Edmonton volatilities, you have this kind of term structure. Essentially, if you set the Mannonist definition based on the standardized variable z, then the term structure of the Edmonton wall does not depend on the wall-wall process. It only depends on the drift, doesn't depend on the diffusion, and that holds for all models. Okay? So here it seems like it has a wall-wall, but it's just part of the drift. This is the drift process. Okay? So that is also satisfied. So essentially, the Edmonton term structure is a weighted average of two numbers. The short term is ST, the long term is theta, so you just get a weighted average of these two numbers. Okay. And in the currency options market, right, the options are quoted in terms of deltas, like D1, D2 is kind of is a good measure to have. So I always thought the currency market, the over-the-counter currency market is more advanced because they are using the right measure. The equity index over the counter market, they also quote an implied vol, but they tend to quote the strike in terms of relative strike in percentage of the spot. So they would give you 80, 100, say 120 percent of the underlying spot, right, in terms of relative strike. So here we consider an alternative specification where the moneyness is measured by the locked relative strike relative to the spot. Then you also get a complex formula. But in this case, we specify slightly different dynamics, still mean reversion, but here instead of vol, we use a variance. So the implied variance becomes a log normal process, right, which is simple and fair. And now I also have a quadratic equation not in vol, but in variance. Right? Here is I to the power of 4, so that's the variance squared, and variance squared, variance constant. You can solve it, okay? And in this case, in the limit of zero, tau equals to zero, you actually get a quadratic function. Originally, I thought it's wrong. It's not wrong. It's really if you define the wall surface in terms of the standardized Mannonist z, then for any continuous price dynamics, wall can jump. But as long as the price dynamics is continuous, the smile at short term is flat. There's no smile in terms of z. But you could have a smile in terms of the log strike. Okay, and as long as the return of all process are stationary, then in the very long run, the wall surface should be flat too, right? Normality kicks in because of central limit theorem. So that's why in the long run, all the implied wall converge to theta, okay? So that's just, and the implied wall here, the Edmonton implied variance, you can plug them in. Also, although I'm representing Z, K, I'm setting it to Z, then still I get a kind of term structure that purely depends on the drift of the vol process, which is still kind of consistent. Okay, so this is, see, Tim Gettler has a SEI model. He said the model is stochastic vol inspired. It doesn't have a derivation, but somehow, I guess, by looking at the vol surface, it come up with a shape that looks like fitting the shape pretty well, and it's trying to also match Roger Lee's moment condition, which says that the implied variance in terms of log strike should be linear asymptotically, okay? And it has to be within the slope of 0 and 2, cannot be over 2, okay? And that's his slope. And in our case, actually, we get the asymptotic slope at the boundary too, which means it's kind of extreme for our specification. The moments are only finite for the first one. The variances is even not finite, I think. So that may imply something about our specification, right, about the dynamics. But it does satisfy this kind of asymptotic linearity condition. Okay? So to summarize about these two models, so we specify two simple processes for implied variance. One is square root, the other is log normal. Both have a mean reverting kind of behavior. And given that it has six coefficients, given that you can solve a quadratic equation to get the whole wall surface, right? As long as you have, you know, enough option price to identify these six parameters, the whole wall surface is out. Now, the closest analogy in the traditional literature is really Heston model. Right? Heston model also has a mean reverting square root process. It has five parameters. I add eta to separately control the wall. Right? Here, they don't have that because it's all controlled by kappa. Otherwise, it's very similar. But how do you solve this? You first derive the analytical solution for the return Fourier transform. And then you either use quadrature method or fast Fourier inversion to numerically calculate the option value. But if you want to translate it into implied vowel, you need to do another root finder. Right? You can make it very fast. It's a monotonic relation. But still, you need a kind of search to get the implied vowel. Right? So that solving a quadratic equation, I said, is about 100 times faster than solving this, probably more. I'm ignoring the last step. I'm doing some pre-processing. I'm still 100 times faster. And also, obviously, these are approximations. How many data points, like numerical points, do you use to for the numerical integration? That also determines the speed and accuracy, right? So we don't have that problem. So we can see the simplicity. And together with this kind of models, I'm proposing a daily calibration model, but I call it a dynamic calibration. So normally I make a distinction between daily calibration, which I regard them as more or less inconsistent because every day you get new parameters, in a sense, right? Versus dynamic consistent calibration, where you fix the parameter and only allow the state variables to change. So in our case, we're changing the parameters every day, everything is changing, so I call it a calibration. But on the other hand, I call it dynamic calibration. I want to use yesterday's number as a starting point. Right? So I set up this system where my calibration can be very fast, even for Heston. You know, I can calibrate Heston model very fast in this approach. So what I did is I assume these parameters are states, make them a random walk. It's not the right assumption per se, because like the variance, I know it's a mean reverting process. But this is more like a setup so that I can use yesterday's number as my starting point. If I don't have new information, I still use yesterday's number, right? It's a simple setup without extra parameters. And here I need some parameters to control the relative scaling. Then the measurement equation is measured by implied volatilities, right? In this, for our model, it would be on implied vowels. So Heston model, calculating implied vowel involves extra calculation, so I may want to cut that. I may want to do it on the option price space. Then I have to do implied vowel calculation later, okay? So this setup has 6 to 7, I call it auxiliary parameters on the measurement variance and the state variance. So these are more like the relative value thing, which controls on how much you try to fit the new point, right? You have yesterday's number, now you have new observation. How much you trust the new observation, right? If you trust it a lot, you set this error variance to a very small number, you move there. Or you say, how much these things tend to vary. If you have a parameter that's very stable over time, you set that number to be very small. Even today's things is changing, you don't allow it to change as much. So it's more like a relative balancing between yesterday's number and today's new information. So after calibration, the calibration of, as I said, of tainers of data is just less than a second. For Heston model, 1 minute is still very fast, right? In the options pricing hedge fund, we implemented a model more complicated than Heston. We calibrate 1,500 stocks, options on 1,500 stocks in 25 seconds. It's fairly fast, very robust. In a day where somehow the data is broken, I only get 2 or 3 numbers, you still get it fitted because you have yesterday's prior, right? You're only moving the level going through that point. You still generate a decent log surface. So this method is quite stable. And since the measurement is equation is nonlinear, so we use something called infinity common future. Essentially, it's like a binomial tree. You sample 2 points or 3 points or trinomial tree, 3 points to approximate the distribution. Some people use particle future, which needs to do random draws, right? So I guess simulation and the binomial tree are the two extremes. You're doing, trying to do something in the middle, right? And binomial tree says that I'm going to sample my points deterministically, one up, one down. Simulation says I'm going to sample the data randomly, but I use lots of data points, right? So you're trying to make your random number more deterministic so that you don't need to sample as much. And so I applied to currency options and also index options. So I use options on dollar yen and dollar pound. These are their average implied vol surface. So you see this skewed smile, a short maturity, long maturity. For dollar pound is more symmetric than dollar yen. So these are the standard quoting method in the currency options market. Actually, it's more complex than that. People debate on exactly how to do the translation. I call this translation as our simplified academic way of translating them. In the industry, actually, they debate a lot on that thing. So these are time series of the implied vols, so it varies a lot over time. And here is something interesting, not particularly related to our model, but the red line is the long-term risk reversal, which is measuring the skew of the distribution. The blue line is the short-term, 1 month versus 5 years, okay? What you see is that before 2000, the long-term skew is set to zero, okay? That's how traders at that time extrapolate their vol surface, okay? You want to quote at 5 year, I extrapolate my add money implied vol to a certain level, then I give you a flat vol surface, okay? That's normally what people do. I guess they believe in central limit theorem. Everything is normal in the long run. But after 2000, they don't believe in that anymore. I said, no. So actually, the long-term skew is more than short-term skew. I said, where's central limit theorem? I understand central limit theorem, but I cannot use it because I'm going to lose lots of money. So that gives us a hard time for modeling because most of the model we specify are stationary, which means sooner or later it's flat, but it's not. In the data. This goes to 5 years. If I get 10 years of data, what these guys do is they flat interpolate risk reversal. Essentially, they are flat interpolating skewness, saying that after 5 years, since I don't have information, I'll assume the skewness is the same at 5 years and 10 years. Right? So central limit theorem doesn't kick in anymore. It's an assumption. It's how traders kind of try to protect themselves. But how do you model that? It's just a tough, tough thing to do. Okay. Butterfly spread is the same thing. The curvature is zero. Now it's big and varying. Okay. And so pricing performance, root mean squared errors for square root, log normal model, and Hess model, they're very similar, right? Log normal, I guess, and Hess model for dollar yen is about the same. It's slightly better for log model, but I cannot tell. And for dollar pound, the log normal is better. But the performance is very similar. They're all okay, except our model is dramatically simpler, I can't say that, right? And I also calibrate these two S&P index options. These are also over-the-counter data at 80 to 120 percentage of stop in moneyness, and maturity is also from 1 year to 5 years. So these are long-dated options. So the surface normally is skewed. And also, if I standardize the skewness in terms of the standardized measure, as short maturity is here, long maturity is there, it also increased. The negative skewness also increased in the more recent data. So for both equity and currency options market, they don't believe in central limit theorem, essentially. Right? They are saying something is wrong with that. They're trying to break it. Okay? See, the skewness is increasing on average, not declining over time. And so variation, these are the implied vol levels. Long-term vol tends to be a bit higher, right? This is the term structure. These are the skews. See, the short-term skew tends to be bigger than long-term skew. No, this is short-term skew. This is a long-term skew. Long-term skew tends to be even more heavily negative skewed. And pricing performance. In this case, log normal model is the best, 0.66, about half in terms of vol points. These are like root mean squared error in terms of vol points, percentage points. This is half a vol. This is one vol. And R square about 5 percentage points better. And also, our model generates less serial correlation in the pricing error, right? That's kind of one of the criteria for alpha generation, right? For an investor, you don't really want your model to fit the market perfectly, then you don't have any trading opportunity anymore. You want the model to generate large error, but fast reverting error, right? That's kind of, you're trying to identify the good opportunity. So that's another criteria. Basically, based on all three criteria, the log normal fits pretty good, except that, in addition to that, on top of that, there's no Fourier transform to code up. It's just a quadratic equation, and it's super fast, right? So that's it, right? So option traders are deeply entrenched in the Black-Scholes implied volatilities, and they do so for good reasons. And ideally, if we can model implied vol dynamics directly and generate, you know, implications on the vol surface directly, it would be ideal because these guys quote on it, right, instead of generate implications on vol surface. Market models try to do half of it, right? They're trying to model the market yield component of it, but they're taking the vol surface as given. They're not trying to generate implications on vol surface. So what we do is we model the whole dynamics, and we are deriving implications, no arbitrage implications on the vol surface, okay? So the dynamics and the vol surface are guaranteed to be consistent in terms of dynamic and arbitrage, right? And in this case, we don't fit the vol surface perfectly. The market deviation, then you can think of it as the alpha generator. And so this new approach generates some very promising results, right? Because the model is extremely simple, and the performance is pretty good, and it's super fast. But this is kind of a new direction, quite different from our standard literature, where you extend a one-factor vol to a two-factor, you know, add a jump and things like that. It's quite different the direction, and how to make it work further along the lines is hard to know. For example, the PD guarantees no arbitrage between any option and a basis option, right? But if my specification of the implied vol dynamics is not good, there could be arbitrage, static arbitrage, between three or four options. I don't really know. How do I exclude that? I don't really know. If I specify instantaneous return variance, I don't have that issue. Here, because you are simultaneously specifying the whole thing, if you're not careful, your specification could just does not allow anything. Okay. So how do you map that, in a sense, map this implied vol dynamics to dynamics of instantaneous return variance, and then, you know, back and forth to get better specifications to make sure that your specification really excludes arbitrage of all types, that's still open. That's a good question to do. And also, in the traditional option pricing literature, we are all talking about the multi-factor volatility dynamics. Right? You have short-term vol, long-term vol, they're varying independently. And you have this skew, like the kind of jump intensity also varies differently from the normal market movements. So we don't have that yet. And also, you know, how do you accommodate discontinuous price movements in this kind of setup so that you can also fit, say, a five-day option, right? For a purely continuous dynamics, you don't get any smile at very short term. So it cannot be used to fit short-term maturities. But these questions are all open, and how to do it is not that clear yet. But hopefully, down the road, some people will come up with something interesting. Thanks. No, I haven't tried it yet. No. I haven't even finished this paper yet. It's fairly new. This is my. In the same fashion? Normally, I want to be more specific nowadays. I don't like these hidden factor models anymore. I want to say one factor is short term, one factor is long term, one factor is jump, one factor is diffusion. I try to give the factor more economic meaning, but I haven't really thought about it. But what I want to add first actually is the jump to be able to price the short term, because currently I'm doing data calibration, right? Data calibration essentially I have lots of factors. Right, because I allow my short-term, long-term to vary in any way each day. So the dimensionality is not a problem. I know it's inconsistent, but it's not a problem I can fit. But no matter how you switch these parameters, I still cannot fit a short-term option because the implication of continuous price dynamics. Right? It says there's no smile at a very short term. So that's still a constraint. So the first thing, if I have the energy to keep working along these directions, would be to somehow either accommodate jumps, or a current kind of industry practice is to assume that ST is not known. The instantaneous vol level, you don't really know. It's a hidden variable, right? Currently, we infer it, but if you say, I don't know, and there is a probability, right? You use filter approach, you get an estimate, but you have a mean and a variance. So if you assume a distribution around it and take an expectation, you generate curvature. Essentially, that way you can generate smile at short term. And some kind of market people are already using that idea, I think. Instead of using jumps, they're putting that kind of thing in. That'll give you some smile at short term. But how to put it here? This is a whole new system, right? So how to get it to work, I don't really know. And I'm still trying to figure out all the like understanding around it, whether my specification makes sense or not. It's hard to think it through at this point. Okay. But anybody who's interested in working on it, feel free to do it. And see, you might be able to come up with something interesting. At least it's no longer a dead end. It's an open end. And these models are so simple. Suppose you didn't come up with a quadratic equation. This sort of order doesn't really matter. It's still pretty good. So what we are guaranteeing is no arbitrage between one option and another option and a stock, right? The Black-Scholes model guarantees no arbitrage between one single option and a stock, right? The bound is always there, I'm assuming it's there, right? So it's guaranteeing that. So I'm guaranteeing no dynamic arbitrage between these three, which means that these three can form a risk-neutral portfolio, like risk-neutral portfolio give you risk-free rate. If you cannot do that, then there's arbitrage. But I'm not simultaneously saying that 10 options together, right? So for example, if every three is fine, doesn't mean all five together are statically is fine, actually. Okay? It's hard to think it through, but it doesn't guarantee that part.
Yeah, I think actually, so that's Martin Schweizer, I think, and Bessel, they are very much concerned about this whole issue of static arbitrage combined with dynamic arbitrage.
Yeah.
Imagine, even if you have no static arbitrage right now,
okay,
and you use this model to dynamically evolve forward, and then ask the question again, do I now have static arbitrage,
okay,
or not?
Okay.
I don't think you can guarantee.
I cannot even guarantee no static arbitrage today.
No, but suppose you do.
Okay.
Then you use, so for whatever reason, your surface is such that there's no current static arbitrage.
So they are, I think they are more concerned with this kind of approach, because you are starting with, they say, surface, which you think there's no arbitrage. You try all kinds of numerical ways to check there's no arbitrage, but your implied vol surface is so weird, right? Looks, but you can check, it's still no arbitrage. It's weird, but there's no arbitrage. But now you're trying to say that, hey, the drift has to be that surface plus the Monte Carlo component. If the surface is weird, the drift will be weird.
Yeah.
It will generate things that potentially allow arbitrage, right? But for us, we are specifying these two.
Yeah.
If our specification on that is good, if I generate a surface today, that's no arbitrage. If I keep the parameters constant, tomorrow's vol surface will be the same, there won't be an arbitrage, right? So that's not an issue. But my problem is I cannot guarantee that my implied surface today guarantees no static arbitrage. Obviously, I can check on that. But I cannot guarantee. Actually, one guy found an arbitrage at the far outer money somewhere. He used a very weird parameter. He said, I can break your model by setting something to 200 and something very low. But still, that means my dynamics are not fully kind of foolproof, right? Based on your calibrated parameters, it's not a problem. But it's not saying any parameter range it works. So that actually is our big concern. Because you want to specify a model that, given as long as all these coefficients are positive, real, you want it to have something, reasonable, right? here, if my parameters are very weird, I could have arbitrage right away today. Yeah. If I have it today, tomorrow I cannot say anything, right? That concern is really the market model. Even the HGM has that issue, right? Because if you have a bad forward curve today, your tree, the tree you built looks very bad, right? So that's just the thing. You cannot really take today's forward curve as given. You want to smooth the forward curve and then go build your dynamics. Otherwise, the whole implied dynamics are weird. So this approach, this market approach actually has that issue. I think it's kind of a well-known issue there. That's true. Potentially, I can get rid of everything, right? But I still want to figure out the problem. I figure out some kind of relation. Then I know how to specify it. The question is where to add. Maybe you can think about it. You have a, like if you have a nice way of adding a factor, then the generated implication that's also kind of simple and clear. That would be cool. I honestly, I haven't even thought along that direction yet because these things are really new. This is my first formal presentation I made. The paper is ugly. I just put the results there. I haven't really read it through yet.
Okay. So I think people in Western perhaps the question now.
No.
If not, then time for a break. We'll be back here in 17 minutes, 25 after.